I'm actually so excited for today. This is our third Behind the Curtain. The intention of Behind the Curtain is for ODIATH to bring internal practitioners to our community to discuss their experiences and to create a learning forum. When this actually was announced to the engagement committee that we were going to pursue this series, I thought of Steve LeDuc immediately. And I worked with Steve starting in 2018 at Raytheon Company. And Steve doesn't know I'm going to say this. He is the best colleague to have. He doesn't just do his role, he's part of enabling everyone else to be successful. I would walk down the hall at Raytheon, we called it HR Row. And most of the doors are closed in HR Row because everything's confidential. But whose door wasn't closed? Steve LeDuc's. Steve welcomed conversation. He encouraged, he listened to problems. He truly is a keystone for the organization that I was in, and I know for the others that he has led. So I'm really thrilled to announce our speaker for today, Steve LeDuc, head of org development at Takeda. And today's conversation is The Insider Looks Out. I'm not going to share his biography because that's actually part of the presentation. He's going to walk you through his learning experience as a practitioner. So we're not going to just get the Takeda view, we're going to get Steve's practitioner view. So thank you.
Thanks, Megan. That was so kind. I really appreciate the intro. When Megan approached this and with me that with this opportunity, I guess the longer I've worked in the industry, I continue to have more and more defined opinions on, the value of the work and how it gets done. And as I'll show you that throughout my career, I've moved from roles as an HR business partner, as a recipient of org development, org design activities, and then moving into that responsibility and then having direct org design responsibilities throughout my career. So I have stories that are associated with my history. I know we all have stories, and maybe some of your stories, maybe some of my things will resonate for you. Maybe you've got some ads, maybe you've got some gentle disagreements, and that's entirely fine. And so this is a little bit just associated with my perspective. I just wanted to give an idea. So I've been at Takeda for now about 5.5 years. For those of you who aren't aware, if you pay attention to any of the pharmaceutical ads that are on TV, which would be a lifetime commitment, unfortunately, with the amount of advertising that pharmaceuticals do, Entyvio is one of our major products that we have. But we are a 245-year-old Japanese pharmaceutical company with global representation. So here in the United States, with a primary representation in Cambridge, Massachusetts, just across the Charles River from Boston, with our global headquarters in Tokyo. And the origination of the company 245 years ago was actually in central Japan in Osaka. And we do operate, as you can see, in 80 countries around the world in building out our partnership and our activities. It's been a nice opportunity on the pharmaceutical side. And so a number of the things that I will share with you will go through kind of that my little bit my work history. So I've kind of got six pieces of advice, and you may or may not find this useful. But as I've gotten to this role, it kind of starts with this idea of, if you're in the org design role, you're the org development person, you are that specialist within the institution, you're the expert, and act accordingly. So the development of that expertise, from an educational standpoint, I started at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst a long time ago. Took a wonderful IO psychology course with a gentleman by the name of Stan Moss, and it was a big emergence then. Stan actually had a Purdue PhD. So for those of you in the United States, it would make sense that good origination of some of the organizational development activities started at some of the Big Ten Midwestern schools. Following that and some early on role responsibilities, some early on jobs, I got a subsequent two master's degrees. I got one, my MBA in finance at the Rutgers School of Business located in Newark, and then transitioned to getting my master's in human resource management at Rutgers as well. And just from a name-dropping standpoint, I was fortunate enough to take courses with both Richard Beatty, I think is now at Michigan, and Mark Husilid on the human capital side. So some really top-flight professors that I was able to make connections with in my time going through that. And it really helped to solidify the perspective of the value of kind of the systemic nature of looking at the organization. I'll give the kind of the lead in going forward now. Most of my design experience has been utilizing and implementing the STAR model by Jay Galbraith. And familiar with a number of the other systems models that have been presented. And as you can see there, the experience at Teachers College. It was a principles and practices of org development certification that they ran two folks, kind of on the OD early ages with Warner Burke and his crew, Harvey Hornstein, Billy Alban, kind of back to the Bethel, Maine days, and kind of rounding out the perspective of the kind of the truer organizational development perspective. In my time, it kind of going through my career, I found the opportunity to challenge myself by staying relevant with the work that I did and being kind of that maintaining that expertise and acting accordingly. And I just actually wrapped up 10 years of teaching as an adjunct at the Carroll School at Boston College, teaching a course on managing change. Which change at scale at a transformative organizational level includes design. So I would introduce my undergraduate students to Jay Galbraith's STAR model for sure. In addition, introduction to org behavior and leadership. And the value of that balanced opportunity was really making sure that I stayed on my toes. So sometimes as an internal, you can get lazy, right? It's easy to pick up the phone and call folks that you know within the industry, consultants. And it wasn't so easy for me to do that if you were the teacher. And so a lot of the times, and some of the questions that I get from my undergrads for sure was very fundamental, particularly if you're looking at the idea of managing change. And I did not advocate a model, by the way. All models are six of one, half a dozen of the other. You can go back to Lewin, you can go back to Kubler-Ross, and it's just simply a transition for human beings for going from point A to point B. The bigger the point distance, the greater the trajectory. And I would get questions that would challenge me from a professorial standpoint, and so I was always also changing my syllabus. I felt that there would be tremendous irony in keeping the same syllabus 10 years in a row, given the amount of change that occurs in the world, and then given the nature of the title of the course that I was presenting. In the lower right, I actually have a picture. So, in as much as, maybe internal abuse isn't enough within the corporate sphere and the roles that we do sometimes, I've been a basketball official for the past 15 years, and more recently in the picture there with a fellow referee of mine, a volleyball official, actually keeps me connected. My daughter played volleyball at the college level, and it's kind of a connection for me to my daughter, and I enjoy the game. I enjoy officiating the game. And so in why I mentioned the refereeing is that is absolutely kind of the net of the role. You're the expert. And so the acting accordingly, sometimes you'll blow that whistle, and particularly in basketball, and particularly if there's any fans who've been watching the NBA finals, Depends, right? What we say is 100% of the people will disagree with 50% of your calls. And the kind of the net of it is you're still the expert in the acting accordingly and how you show up and represent yourself on the floor. So it also helps to give me a little bit of balance too, given the work environment. And certainly in those games, the flow is of a very systemic nature. Kind of the on the expert side, looking at the work experience, Megan mentioned our introduction to each other and the world of Raytheon. This was Raytheon prior to the acquisition by United Technologies, which I'll talk about a little bit about later. But really, my first test in coming into Raytheon in 2011, they presented me with an organizational. I was hired as an OE professional there, organizational effectiveness for one of their larger businesses called Integrated Defense Systems, which did large scale radars, Patriot missile defense systems, which has been in the news as of late for sure. And kind of the test was an HR person put together an org design plan for all the functions and businesses within this particular organizing unit. And they were like, should take you a couple of weeks at a click. So over the next few months, you should be done. And I kind of chuckled to myself. I was like, okay, this is just overly ambitious. I don't know enough about the organization to do the right things from that perspective. And then fundamentally, there's a lack of understanding about org analysis and organizational design. So what I did is I kind of said, listen, you hired me into this role. So either you're going to, ask me my opinion or you're going to kind of just edict what you need me to do. So I said, listen, and I said, well, what would you recommend as the expert? And I said, well, I recommend you prioritize this. Where do we most impact our customers? What's most important from a business perspective? What's most important to get done first, second, third? I made enemies and I say that lightly, not really enemies, but disappointed leaders who were like, I was on the schedule to have this done in the next couple of months, and now I'm pushed off for a period of time, particularly the IT person for that organization. And what I explained to them is I said, listen, I'm only a singular person and I have my priorities. And the priorities were aligned with those of the business and kind of moving forward. So it's an opportunity to not just accept what's done and then scratch your head or pull your hair out trying to figure out how to get it done. It was an opportunity for me to kind of be the expert and to push back in that way. In that expertise, kind of be the expert on the business and the industry you're supporting. I've worked at a bunch of different places. I started out my time in the pharmaceutical space at Merck and Company. And working kind of my first foray there after getting my my MBA in finance. Interestingly enough, the head of HR at the time, a gentleman by the name of Steve Darien, I said, well, why would you hire a guy like me? He said, I can teach anyone how to do the HR stuff. He goes, I can't teach him how the business functions, how to do the finance stuff. And he goes, and you've got that and a willingness to work in the HR space. I thought it was maybe not fair to the HR profession and the capabilities there, but I never forgot that piece of advice because it always kept me oriented into the why the business exists. The businesses don't necessarily exist for the glory of the employees or from an HR perspective. And sometimes our context gets over tilted and we prioritize the HR things and forget about the nature of the business and the business the running. And when we look at stakeholder analyses, sometimes we forget our primary stakeholders, which are our shareholders. And our shareholders are really not interested in sometimes how the sausage is made. They just want it to be good and on their plate in a timely fashion. So pharmaceuticals in its own space, has kind of this idea of the longer trajectory from a developmental perspective. It's 7 to 9 years, a molecule becomes a pill in a bottle or a solution for particular patients. So there's almost an embedded a little bit of patience. You'll find that some of the pharmaceutical industries will go through these cycles of kind of flush with cash, And then struggling and waiting for the next thing to come out from a pipeline perspective. And it's always a bit of a business challenge and a cadence to move those things along. Differently, I put Coopers and Lybrand up there. So for those of you, I know it's PricewaterhouseCoopers, but I was on the Coopers and Lybrand side as a director of operations. And I liked the time that I had at that organization. And primarily, to go back to my connection to Mark Husilid, it was the understanding that the employees at Coopers were, for lack of a better example, just mobile cash registers. And so really it was true kind of human capital management and the effective deployment of resources against audit engagements or internal controls engagements, and really balancing who was necessary to be on that engagement and managing client expectations externally on the professional services side was extremely important. So it helped to kind of balance my perspective in terms of the businesses are always being product oriented.
Augmenting your needs.
Oh, hi, is there a
Don't tell
question?
me that.
Okay. So just help me to balance that on the professional services side and from a connectedness to the product side. If you look on the alternate perspective, for a number of years I was at Deutsche Bank prior to and then post its acquisition of Bankers Trust, and ultimately head of HR for their global cash management business. And a very different perspective from an HR standpoint, and a particularly in org development and in org design standpoint. Design was always oriented around how to maximize revenue. And it was always about taking advantage of opportunities. So the business cadence, the demand expectation, the flow of changes was completely different from what you experienced on the pharmaceutical side. Yeah, potentially flush with cash, but man, they were always not only interested on ROI, but certainly other things like weighted average cost of capital and other evaluations on what we were actually doing from an HR standpoint. And so the pace and the business cadence really differs when you look at design. The expectation of the organization to tolerate the amount of time you're going to allocate, and then the responses and the results that you're going to deliver. So one of the things that I've been able to see at Design, and I also had time at EMC, and supporting, he's now the CEO at Intel Corporation, but the gentleman by the name of Pat Gelsinger, who is their EMC's head of engineering, was really to understand, kind of that shift of business cadence. One thing in the EMC side, which is now part of Dell, that I never forgot, was that 70% of the revenues were based on products that were 18 months old or less. So that really, and I can only imagine that it's shrunk in the tech space, right? And I can, looking back through my job history and even on the org design history, the value of going through all of the data gathering and the interviews and the surveys and stuff like that. My gosh, I can't think of how much of my life was dedicated to just grinding through reading results and trying to make sense of what you were seeing and listening to from the people you were talking with in the organization, and how now you just plug it into Claude, into ChatGPT, into whatever tool you have, and it just spits out a pretty decent analysis, right? And after you're reading, the umpteenth interview and survey results is probably better than you, because it doesn't get tired and starts to see ghosts in the data, and starts to allow your biases to infiltrate, the design responses that you have. So the other final piece is just that the culture is really differentiated. And then my final role before getting to Takeda in the Raytheon space, where we were much more dedicated into org design work. And the why so? Because the gentleman that ran the business that when I joined Raytheon, a gentleman by the name of Tom Kennedy, when I think of the why the org design, and particularly the STAR model value, was of value to him. He was a project manager in their space and airborne systems business on the Raytheon side, and he had a particular challenge on a project. And Six Sigma wouldn't fix it. All sorts of executive interventions weren't fixing it. The fix was a simple org analysis and a redesign of the project team in order to satisfy the client needs. It saved Tom, and I won't say that it saved him, job-wise or otherwise, but it saved the project. And it gave him kind of that recognition. And it was something that he became really invested in. We got to the point where we would tell people, and they'd say, "Well, can you explain the straw model to me?" For example, I'd say, "You know what? Have Tom explain it to you. He does a better job about it than we do," because he had an embedded passion. And it fed into the value of the OE roles that showed up in the organization, and then the design work that we were able to do in supporting the organization. And he was understanding of simple concepts that culture change takes time, it takes a level of commitment, and it takes hours, as well as the value of doing good design work at scale and where you looked at that in the right way. So it's been a value to have that cross-organizational, cross-industry experience. And I really took the time to make sure that I understood the peculiarities and uniqueness in order to do the work that I did for them in the right way. Kind of this, everything is an opportunity for you to learn, and for the client particularly. So in the des you know, when you get into the design work, really, nobody understands org design and good org design in within the businesses, nor do they have to. They can continue to get by and be extremely successful in their jobs without having to understand it, which is kind of the good thing for why we exist both internally and externally. The nice opportunity that I had, and it was kind of the cross-learning experience, and I'll give you the kind of the contrast and where I was doing direct org design work at Raytheon. Kind of the best org design that I had ever worked on. So the picture that this guy is longingly looking at here, it's called and everything in the military space is an acronym. So it's kind of called MRFs and CRFs. So it's radar frequency system, and it's either the Ku band, which is the K, or multifunction, which is the M. And so as you look at that unit or that big truck, there's kind of that disco ball in the middle, which is a radar, which we could evaluate incoming threats. And I think it's being used now against unmanned aerial vehicles, right? So flying drones. And then what it does is it gives the system a response to do effector. Response. So whether it's Coyote, which are kind of these little short little missiles, or guns, in order to take out the incoming threat. At the time, drones weren't a big deal when I was working with this particular client located in McKinney, Texas. But what was a big deal was we still had forward deployed troops who were located in Afghanistan, who were constantly being attacked with mortars, with RPG rounds, et cetera. So when you have these battalions located a lot of times in the middle of a valley, they were at tremendous, tremendous risk. And so the Army was requesting this of Raytheon, almost like what we do nowadays to order things on Amazon and then get mad that we didn't get it next day because we're paying for Prime delivery service. So the Army was very intent on getting this returned around. And if you understand the defense contractor model, you kind of put in an idea and you go through this RFP process. And if you're selected based on a design, and then you got to go build it. So the military knew that this existed. So they actually just wanted to accelerate a lot of those things and just get to a build and delivery standpoint. It wasn't at all what this project team was structured for. What they were structured for was kind of the tried and true defense contractor way of developing. And so the work that I did with them was to help them to understand good design principles, but then to work with them of saying, okay, what are the real things that you need to do in order to deliver value? And I ended up working with this team over a year period. The kind of the meaningful part for me is, one day I walked into, they kind of had their conference room allotted for this particular project team. And I walked into the project room and there was a picture of a flag, a little bit worn, a little bit frayed around the edges, with a picture of a battalion in a very kind of deserty, acrid environment, with the flag present. And it accompanied a letter by a captain that basically thanked this particular project team for delivering this product, which saved their lives, right, from any of the incoming threats. And what ended up happening is, as these things were deployed and the mortar rounds and the RPG rounds were intercepted, the folks that were attacking these forward deployed battalions just kind of gave up. It was a waste of, the kind of sacrificing their ammunition, and they were like, okay, forget it. We'll go find something else to do. And, as I'm looking at kind of the impact of the work that was done, the project lead put his hand on my shoulder and he was like, he goes, pretty amazing what we were able to do, huh? And more than anything, what I was able to learn was just the tremendous value of what you're able to deal deliver from a design perspective. It's not always just, org charts and boxes and transformative efforts, but at its core, I reflected that, Peter Block, who I'm a huge fan of Flawless Consulting, he's gotten to this point where he's not a fan of working with senior leaders anymore. He likes to work kind of at the mid-layer level. And it was very much my experience. It was almost like a very ground surface level where the things we were able to do from a design perspective had a direct and immediate impact for our clients. Similarly, on the worst side, it was as a result of integration efforts preceding United Technologies' acquisition on the Raytheon side. And there was this debate on supplier engineering. And it was actually referencing Flawless Consulting. It was a poor contracting on my side. And I contracted with two peers who basically one would win and one would lose depending on the design. And present, I went through the interviews, I gathered data and presented multiple design options, facilitated sessions in order to get to the right idea. And everybody was aligned except for these two leaders. And my contracting should have been at the next level up so that it could have been the right decision. So one leader accepted the results because they won, and one leader just denied the results because they lost. And then they continued to appeal their case and to require re-adjudication. And as an internal, in a great sense of frustration, because it was a lot of org design demands on us prior to the acquisition being finalized at that time, I kind of said, yeah, I'm out. I go, kind of good luck with this. And everyone was very disappointed that, from a consulting perspective, I kind of washed my hands of them and their shenanigans. And so the learning there for me was what was not only A, the right layer of contracting, but it probably required a lot more coaching from me for those two particular individuals. And, which is a bit difficult at that time because we were operating like this and it wasn't a lot of face to face. Megan talked about walking down the hall and coming by my open office. We were at the initial stages of COVID. And so everything was not only these type of two dimensional interactions, but the technology, if you remember, was pretty wonky, as was the network connections, everything else. So, always that learning opportunity, and it's a good time for reflection. The military term of after action reviews is of huge value as you look back at what you should have learned and what they should have learned. So kind of the small jobs can start and then grow as you build a relationship. So after doing the OE work, I did leave, after the deal was finalized, just within just short of a year post the now what is kind of called, I believe, RTX Corporation, the integration of the Pratt and Whitney assets with Raytheon's and Collins Aerospace and with Raytheon's base of missiles and radar defense systems. So going to Takeda, I actually walked into a learning and development role. And wasn't so worried about the work that I'd necessarily be doing from a design perspective. And I knew that I could influence good outcomes. And so the role was different, supporting their R&D organization. And the head of the R&D organization is still there now, a gentleman by the name of Andy Plump, who's an extremely brilliant physician scientist, and very much a people person, which is certainly a welcomed addition for folks in these types of roles. So, as businesses do, they go through their particular changes, and there was an opportunity that presented itself, and I found this window of opportunity, and I said, Andy, I said, org design is a science. I was trying to appeal to his sciencey side, and I said, org design is a science. And I said, and I'd love to share with you the impact of that science and how we could utilize that to make better decisions. And I still can recall it was kind of prior to everybody checking out in advance of the late December winter slash Christmas breaks. And I got an hour of his time, which, given the volume of responsibility he has, was probably more generous than I deserved. But what I was able to do was really to show him not only examples in the work environment of good design, really to introduce him to the simple concepts of focusing on strategy and how design isn't just boxes and sticks and organization charts, that it is the integration of the entire system and how do you create better balance within that particular system. So that happened. I had been there, I think, at that point in time, almost 3 years. And so it was a tremendous amount of patience. But how do you build those, particularly as the internal, build those relationships, and they begin to trust you and allow you to play? Early on in my career, somebody at Merck and Company had said to me, I had all these kind of grand ideas. And they said, listen, using a sports analogy is never a good thing, but that's okay. They did it this time. And they said, listen, learn how to block and tackle, and I'll let you play quarterback. And I kind of never forgot that example either, because it helped me to understand some of those fundamentals. So, as much as possible, I think we as the internal folks need to engage and kind of manage that external consultant relationship. We, if we're doing our jobs well, understand the intricacies of the design networks within our organizations, the why behind some of those design choices and design decisions, and context on the bigger things, the culture, the behavior, kind of the business cadence, and the why of the organization. And that, we really should. I've seen tremendous value in being able to have close engagement with those consultants. I saw it in my time at Raytheon, and I know that Amy and Kate Kessler are regulars in the ODF network, and so they don't need any more adulation, but I'll throw another chip in the fire for them and for Roland Burns and for Amy and her organization. And it was a very good and working relationship with them on getting good org design best practices within the Raytheon ecosystem, all the way up until, unbeknownst to us on the United Technologies side, the CEO at the time in United Technologies, Greg Hayes, was actually friendly with Greg Kessler. And so that actually supported us in some of the design work that we do there as well. Both players have an important responsibility. The biggest difficulties I've had is when somebody goes outside. A consulting firm, large one, and I know you all know the name, but I'm not going to name it because I know this is being recorded. But they were a huge fan of design was all about spans and layers and boxes and sticks. And it just made me want to sit in the corner and rock back and forth and hug my knees for a while and with tears in my eyes as to just the lack of expertise that they had on design. And really, their motivation was to get in good with the leaders at the time, to continue to think about their opportunities for upselling. And to further entrench themselves in the ongoing business, and that there's no value there. And so the externals absolutely have a tremendous amount of expertise and value, and you can work in concert to deliver value for the organization. So, a really good understanding is the external recognize your expertise and role, right? Is there good recognition of value there? I will say publicly right now, I'm working and partnering with Bain which is a large institution, but partnering in a good way. And primarily, it checked some of these boxes. They recognize my role, my expertise. They recognize what they're able to bring to the table and are very willing to listen and to support. And I'm appreciative of the way in which they showed up. And so I'm willing to recognize their expertise. And so it really requires both ends to meet in the middle, to be focused on what are you driving for, right? Is it driving for control and ego, or are you driving for value in the business? So finally, I'm going to go to the this, and this is kind of rings my home base bell. And it's kind of the engage the HR folks. And my first bullet, yeah, I put the quote from Jay from 2002, which I've used over and over and over again as to what true good design is and is not. This idea of a go do, it was a popular phrase in the Raytheon sphere, of this is not something, yours is not to question why, to borrow from the popular poem. And I kind of pushed back and I said, two of the most disabling words that you can give to your employees are a go do. I said, if you have a go do environment, then you don't need to employ people with degrees, with intelligence, with the capability to act. The HR folks are often that meter to kind of the heartbeat of the employees. And they were able to kind of sense out the disabling nature of that language, right? Kind of that go-do language. And I always looked at any of the design work that I did or still am doing as an opportunity, twofold. I'd build a relationship with the HR person and I would educate them in as much as they were willing to be educated. I understand the pressures of the HR business partner role, and I did that and I was there. Most of the time you're reacting. Most of the time you have a good idea to start focusing on things like HR strategy, and one of your employees gets drunk on a business trip and tries to swing and punch a cop, and you get a phone call because they're located in the local jail. And that's an actual story. And it just derails all of the focus that you have to do the strategic things. And so it's really incumbent upon us as specialists in the design space to bring the HR people along and to help them to understand the impact of good design and to educate them and educate them in those projects. And primarily because the execution is going to largely fall to them as leaders say, oh, kind of, we're done with the design stuff. Now I can get back to the work that I do from a day job. So, I did org design instruction at Raytheon. It was kind of fortuitous. It was almost about 70 people, and it was done in the months preceding the acquisition by UTC of Raytheon. Unknowing, we started it, and we started it prior to the announcements. And a couple of months in, the announcements were made. And the interest by the HR people kind of went through the roof after the announcements were made, which was of value. And as well in the Takeda space, I continue to run org design sessions for them as well, and act as that individual to help them to make better design decisions, which has had a really nice net positive impact for the organization. So not that I intended to do this, it really is in my library right there, but thank you to Donald Anderson, who has an org design textbook, which is based on Jay's star model into giving good design approaches and practices. So I got a bonus item. It's not number seven, it's just a bonus item. But really, kind of that idea of accepting the timing of your organization. Sometimes you're extremely busy and frenetic. And I had that a lot of times. And particularly understanding, you're not going to get the good design work done in a Q4. Right, as the business is trying to close if you're a public company. And so sometimes you're the Maytag repairman. Sometimes you're sitting there and you're watching your HR people immersed in compensation planning. You're watching the business immersed in getting products launched out into their customer set. And you may see things that are going on, but you may just have to be patient and wait for it to go by. And if the appliance is working well, So again, I know Maytag Repairman might be a reference that's dating me, but that's okay. He was kind of they were such good appliances that the repairman never had any work to do. But also demand that the organization value the contributions you have. I think the organizational design work that the internals can do and deliver for organizations at scale, leveraging the resources of external consultants, can really bring about better transformation, better anticipation, and proactive responses by businesses to all of the different changes in the geopolitical environment that we're facing now from an organizational perspective. So kind of that's my stories. Those are my six items. And, happy, I don't know, Megan, if you've been getting questions along the way, happy to answer any of those or take any of your inputs if you've got adds to my list. But I appreciate you listening to my stories.
Thank you, Steve. Yes, we do have some questions. We also have a request as well. We have a request which you and I can put together the resources that you've shared. And yeah, so that'll be a nice add-on for the group. But yes, we have some questions. And if anyone wants to ask as well, do you agree with Steve's list? What would you add? Do you all have a story? We can share that. But let's go to our first question. It was from Lindsay. And she heard you say, Steve, that the client doesn't need a deep understanding of org design. And Lindsay agrees with that. And but what point in your experience have you seen value in leaders who have a level of org design competency? So not expertise like a practitioner, but high design fluency, understanding, as Lindsay defines it, meaning it's more than just boxes and sticks.
Thanks, Lindsay. I appreciate your recognition. It really was, and maybe I got to that answer as I shared more about my stories, but it really was Tom Kennedy. I still remember sitting in the audience. He's talking to several hundred leaders as CEO, and he stands up there and he talks about his own project experience utilizing the STAR model. It helped him and his expectation of all of his leaders that when they do design work, it's not just to give them, it's not a quickie answer. It's not, about setting up their own fiefdoms. It's about running the organization better, and you're going to get insights that you wouldn't normally have, and you have to trust in your design professionals to do the work that they do to give you better answers and run your organization. And I'm like, what better lead-in do you need than that from the CEO at the time of the organization? It really came from the top. So I give Tom Kennedy all the credit in the world for being a devoted to Jay and his model contributions.
Thank you, Steve. We have a question from your initial segment talking about the different industries that you were in. And you were talking about time, perspective, expectations. So, how do you map that or place that constraint into org design to support strategy planning or other areas of a business need?
What it used to show up sometimes when in some of the more rapid organizations, like if I think about my time at EMC or even at Deutsche Bank, they used to kind of refer to it as like, I know you do this org design stuff, but I don't want the whole thing. I want org design light. So I'd let them think that I was cheating the system by giving them the Cliff Notes version of a good org design. As opposed to, true org design. So what would that look like? Maybe depending on the importance, the risk, scope and scale, you would want a good threshold for data gathering and data input. Lower the threshold. Force the organization to prioritize, the time. Right. So instead of having me go chase everybody for their data inputs and making time available, right? I need to interview you for at least 45 minutes to an hour and a half to get value out of the conversation. They'd be like, well, I can give you 15 on the way to my next meeting. I'm like, no. So you can force the prioritization of the time, not required flexibility, right? Particularly on the techie side, it was tough to get them during the day. Financial services, I had to never get them during the time that the markets were open. So I can't tell you the number of times that I was taking, car service out of Manhattan, because I had to make time when the business folks were available in their hours that were convenient. But that's kind of the way that I would deploy it. Just recognize their need for a rapid response, rapid engagement, and a high flexibility around their availability.
Thank you, Steve. So we have another from Mike, and it's related to how you work with leaders. So can you walk through how you help your leaders or executives see risk or understand that most design choices have a risk? And then what did you share with them to help them understand the risk and trade-off in relationship to what their design needs may be?
It was thanks for the question, Mike. Their understanding of their risks and their businesses is already done, right? So it would never start when you're looking at it from a design standpoint. It's already there. So I just have them go back to the things that they already know and believe. So if we independently and then in engagement with others, feel that the organization has done a good job of its analysis of risk, external, whatever you want to use, SWOTs, PESL, they're probably not even doing it at that level, but most organizations at scale have pretty good business development strategic functions that do good analysis, right? It's the what does the business do with it that really matters. Then I would ha actually say you've got the first part, you've got the top of the star. How does that then feed into design? And then the balance of risk, it would be, where do you want to place your bets? There was a good element that I've incorporated in some of the design discussions that I'd have where I talk about above and below the line risks, right? So I'd have them classify above the line risks, right? So think of it like a boat. If you get a hole in the side of the boat above the waterline, you can float with the hole in the boat. But what are your below the line risks? And the hole there means that your business is gonna, it will sink, I guess. And so it was again giving them kind of those contextual components where they could frame what they already knew about their business risks and then bin it in a way of understanding, okay, so if you make this design choice, this now is feeding into addressing those below the waterline risks, and getting them away from thinking of anecdote. A lot of times executives will come up with the why not reasons, and they'll come up with the why not reasons that will may not happen in a million years kind of thing. And what I would say is, I said, listen, the design isn't going to solve for 99.9% of your business operating approaches. It's going to solve for the majority, right? Most of the time, the way your business operates is going to get solved by this design. So how do you then design in a way to respond to anomalies? But how do you design for the ongoing nature of the business? But really, Mike, it was just a way of saying, you know the business and bin it in a way to understand how design choices are either going to support or detract from those risk profiles that you already have.
Thank you, Steve. The next question is an interesting one because it's from the culture that we both were in at Raytheon, Steve. So the question is, as an internal practitioner, do you have experience with the HR practitioner roles directly being funded by the leader? If so, how do you help coach the HR practitioner to move beyond the go-do?
Oh my gosh. That's a great, I don't know if I have a good answer because, I think from a design choice, the way that an HR organization needs to be structured is the HR person needs to be the one that pays the paycheck, right? The biggest problems I've ever had were if I went into a country location and you had the country manager and in the next office is the HR person and the country manager pays their paycheck. It was, the amount of, gymnastics that I had to do to get that HR person to even give me any kind of consideration, I understood. Because at the end of the day, I'm not jeopardizing their mortgage or their ability to send their their kid to school or to put food in their mouth, right? That's going to be that country manager individual. So what I would say is having that HR person to really think about what that leader values. One of the leaders I worked with at EMC, he gave me a kind of a broad base. It's a gentleman by the name of Rich Napolitano, and I enjoyed my time with Rich. Rich was an entrepreneurial mindset type of guy. And he was kind of the HR as just do things for me. And I always used to challenge Rich, kind of like from a courage standpoint. I used to say, listen, Rich, let me help you. Because if we're not going to do it this way, then go find yourself another HR person. So I'd almost always kind of threaten to quit, for lack of a better example, which, has its own risks in it. But I got to this fundamental piece where I was like, do I want to continue to just accept the paycheck, but accept the kind of the go-do nature of the work that he was giving me, or to push back and challenge? So he gave me that breadth of opportunity, and I was able to continue to push back. And then, there was an element that at times he was like, I kind of don't like this guy. But I was like, that's not the relationship. I didn't need him to like me. I needed him to respect me in the role that I had and the work that I needed to do. And he did. He was like, you were one of the best HR people I've ever had. He goes, but there were points in times where I didn't like what you were doing for me. And I was like, I don't need you to be liked, right? I got a dog. I have a yo-yo. I have friends, right? I don't need you to like me. I need to do my job well. And the value was is as I would he didn't pay my paycheck. I could go to the head of HR at the time and say, I'm doing my job.
Thank you, Steve. So I have a shift a little bit, and it's a question, as an internal expert, especially if you are the only one or a small team, what are the ways you've scaled up your impact? And my understanding of your career, Steve, is that you have not led org design teams. And when we worked together, I was actually in another part of the HR COE house.
Right. Yeah, we were, we, I mean, I was at Raytheon and I am now, right? As I joke, I said, me and all my friends, right? It was me at Raytheon. It's me at, and the Takeda sphere. Really what I've tried to do is focus at scale, right? So even though I said small jobs can grow, sometimes those relationships, sometimes those people get promoted. Look, it happens in the basketball referee universe. If you want to be an NBA ref, right, you actually, there's camps that you go to so you can build those networks and relationships. But one of the things you do is you work the Division III college games, and those coaches coach a Division I school. They like you, they would like to add you into that assignment rotation. And then those college coaches coach at the NBA level, and they're like, I like that guy, and there you go. So similarly, kind of building those relationships on that side, but trying to force the leverage at scale at an enterprise standpoint. So instead of kind of answering, can you do a team building within, this smaller organization, which is of low impact? The sad answer is no, I can't. And primarily, I got to respect my time and the interaction that I have with the organization. So I work at the executive level in the executive level minus one, and I will deal with the senior HR people and then senior HR people minus one on project work. And then I'm available to consult with anybody, right? Like if Megan walks by, absolutely. And at this stage in my career, this is where I'm going. I ain't going to be a VP of HR anywhere. I'm not going to just, I will finish my time in this role, which is, it's just completely fine to me. So I'm also mindful of how can I take, similar to this opportunity to talk to you today, how can I take what's been rattling around on my skull for 30 plus years and share it with others?
We have two more questions. I think we have 4 minutes, Steve.
Yeah.
So I'll summarize. So, how have you worked, if at all, with strategic workforce planning? Can you give us an example of an org design project where you may have been engaged with workforce planning?
Yeah. Jeez, I want to give you a good example. I folks really struggle at doing this. I have to say, the place that I saw strategic workforce planning being done in an actually longitudinal, planful, thought-provoking way was at Merck. And this was in the 90s. The analysis that they did was to look at the impact to pay over time of bringing, and based on they would extrapolate the attrition rate, they would extrapolate cost and inflation and all those different types of things, and then market where you would hire, right? It's more expensive to hire in New Jersey versus an alternate location. And kind of going through that different trajectory. And then they would make business decisions based on that. I would say, I know that we did a little bit of it on the Raytheon side, Megan, right? And really, there were some folks there that were focused on strategic workforce planning. And the impact was really to understand the make versus buy. Right. Because a lot of times on the design side, and where we would factor it into design, is we would get a design response to say, oh, we need to train, all 1,000 of these people on how to do this. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. Like, let's get back to ground truth here. If you need them to do this by next week, but we're gonna train them on how to do these things, like, they ain't gonna be ready. Like, let's understand adult learning. Like, let's understand how these things kind of net together. And to put these pieces together so there's some sort of a kind of the make buy strategy or even leveraging external resources. Probably did it a little bit more intentionally when I was at EMC. We would actively look at kind of the product lifecycle model in terms of where, and that showed up in kind of how in our design within the organization. It used to be very product focused design, and they actually went to a more lifecycle model. And one of the things that helped in there is when we would identify a skill set, we would actually break it out into, we'd look at the population where the skill set was kind of sunsetting. And we would say, there's a portion of them that have those skills, let's transition them now. There's a portion that can get educated. Let's plan on educating them and then stage them into the work that we're doing. And there's a portion that are never going to learn those skills. And we just would need to exit them out of the organization or find other opportunities for them. But if the demands were rapid, sometimes we'd even consider buying the entirety of a firm and then integrate just from a talent perspective, not necessarily buying assets. We would actually buy the human assets and integrate them into the product life cycle of the work that we're doing. Hopefully, it's a good example.
Thank you, Steve. We're at the top of the hour, and we did have one more question. We'll give that in our registrant package at the end. And Tanya, do you have any additional announcements before I thank Steve?
I'm going to just let folks jump off and run. Other than this, will be the recording will be posted, and I'll let everybody know when it's available here in the next few days. But thank you, Stephen, and thank you, Megan, for making your time to be here today. We very much appreciate. We know there's always prep work involved, and the time and energy to be here and share your experience and years of wisdom and knowledge with the community. Thank you.
Thank you for listening, Ariel. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
And
Thank
I'll stay on the line if anyone has questions about the community as a whole. We'll put Stephen's and Megan's contact information in if anybody has questions to follow up with afterwards on the notification when the recording's posted.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Steve.
Let me pause the recording here to see if anybody stays on and has any questions.